This meeting will come to order, please. Well, today is an exciting day in this committee because we're going to look at the 21st century from a different perspective, from the career and technical side. And we are so fortunate today to have with us Dr. James Stone from the University of Louisville, from the National Research Center for Career and Technical Education. Dr. Stone is formerly from the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus, so we're delighted that he brings to us that flavor of Minnesota and our St. Paul campus, which we know does an outstanding job in preparing for a variety of careers in that whole arena of agriculture and ag-related and veterinary medicine, and so the program goes on to be very, very extensive, and we're very proud of the University of Minnesota for that. Last week was FFA week, and we have some visitors today because we're also going to have Mike Muron presenting. He is the teacher from Forest Lake. So I would like the FFAers from Forest Lake to please stand and say your name. And if you have a position in your FFA organization, would you also tell us that? So let's start at the far end.
I'm Andrew Muron, and I currently serve as the chapter president of Forest Lake High
School. I am Miranda Hunt. I'm Shelby Sandstrom. I'm Amber McCarthy, and next year I will be the director of community services.
I'm Casey Hanson. I'm the 2011 historian.
I'm Jordan Clausen, and I'm the 2011 reporter.
I'm Luke Minchak, and I'm 2011 historian.
I'm Ben Clark.
Very good. Thank you, students, for coming and showing us the strength of FFA, because at least in rural Minnesota, we're a real presence. And I used to teach at Princeton High School, and we still have an active FFA organization. And we've had a few Murons, M-I-R-O-N. Is that spelling of your last name, young man? Yes. So we have probably your cousins, even on staff. And your Aunt Margaret, with whom I taught, yes, welcome. And thanks for being a part of a great organization. With that, can we approve the minutes? We have a quorum and approval of minutes. Let's see. Representative Woodard, would you approve the minutes or move approval, please?
Yes, I move that we approve the minutes from the last meeting.
Thank you. Representative Woodard moves adoption of the minutes. Are there any corrections or additions? Hope you've all checked them over carefully. They're always very much to the point, and Melissa does a great job of proofing along with me. So all those in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted, or the motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Thank you very much. So on to our presenter, Dr. Stone. Please proceed, say your name for the record, and maybe I should first of all ask Jerry Schoenfeld to say a couple words. He represents ag education in this state, and he has provided this wonderful resource for us. So welcome, Mr. Schoenfeld, and maybe you want to say a few brief remarks before Dr. Stone begins.
Madam Chair, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld, and I do work with the Minnesota Association of Agricultural Educators, and I must say that you've done such a good job of introduction that I don't really need to be sitting here, but I did want to tell you a little bit with Dr. Stone to take a perspective of data that he has found over the years relative to kind of the direction that much of education has gone in the last 10 years and what direction it might want to take a look at for the future. In addition to that, later we'll have Mike Muron. Some years ago, we have two concerns, I think, in all career and technical education and ag education specifically. And that is, of course, as we look at budget cuts, unfortunately, career and technical education is oftentimes the first to go within a school system because of it's not a required, it's an elective course. In addition to that, with the changes that have taken place continually, we've been adding additional graduation requirements for a long time, and those additional graduation requirements also have had quite an impact upon career and technical education. And so we may be coming back to you later and talking about those issues. But for today, one of the things that we did want to do was to explain that the graduation requirements, as an example, that we had worked on in the past in this committee, and provide that agricultural science and agricultural economics be able to have a place in that setting. And Mike Murin will be later after Dr. Stone to discuss how ag education has taken that seriously to establish a system by whereby we can take a look at the standards and benchmarks in the science areas and how we've integrated that into our agricultural curriculum. So that will be the second part of it. Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. And Dr. Stone, please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is James Stone, and Madam Chair, I'm delighted to be here. It's always fun to come back to Minnesota at a time like this, this time of the year, to appreciate the fact I don't live here right now. I lived for 21 years in Minnesota. Well, I am delighted to be here, and a couple of quick sort of overview comments, if I may. In thinking about this subject, as I was explaining to the chair lady, I could talk for probably about 2 days nonstop. And so trying to sort of filter out what might be most salient that I could say in 30 to 45 minutes was a task. When I shared this presentation last night with some folks, the first thought was this is a fire hose of data. And so I will apologize in advance for that, but try to at least target the fire hose so that it's helpful and useful to you. The other point I want to make is that I'm drawing a national picture. Every state has its own unique characteristics that affect career and technical education and workforce development in general. So the comments that I'm making are not specific to Minnesota, but I think they are lessons from these data that I think Minnesota could find useful. And also, I'm not talking specifically about agricultural education, because the world of career and technical education is much broader than that, and indeed workforce development is even broader than that. So with that, it's sort of the segue into what I always like to do to start is a philosophical perspective on the following comments. And as I was coming in last night up on White Bear, I saw this scene, and for those of you who can't see the fine print, the car being towed says, "My child is an honor student," and the tow truck says, "My child knows a cam from a rotor." It illustrates, by the way, I personally believe all truth and wisdom lies in the funny pages, so that's usually where I start the day. I think it illustrates one of the challenges we have in thinking about how we make education work better for all kids. And that is, and if you want to hear that three-hour lecture, we've had historically this separation of what I would call practical education from something that we call academic education. And for some interesting reasons, we sort of drifted over to the side of focusing exclusively on academic education. And I would argue to the detriment both of our economy and also to the individuals who ultimately make up that economy. So what I want to do this morning, and again, semi-fire hose, I've tried to narrow it down a little bit, but I want to look just briefly at some myths and realities when it comes to things like the emerging labor market. I want to just take a quick look at what almost 30 years now of what we might call school reform has wrought. Most of you probably are familiar with the report that came out in the early 80s called A Nation at Risk, which kicked off this now 25, almost 30-year effort to try to fix what we perceive as a problem with public education. And then the last, I want to look at the role of career and tech ed at meeting the needs both of students, the community, and more broadly, the economy, and indeed the labor market. Now, because I live and die by data, that's what I'm going to be sharing. I long ago learned that many, if not all, of the assumptions that drive our behavior in no matter what realm we may find ourselves, there are data that are useful in understanding whether those assumptions indeed are valid and whether we ought to temper those assumptions with what I like to think of, in my world, laughingly think of as reality. I am a member of the Academy, and I have worked studiously all my life to avoid working all my life. So as a college professor, I say that proudly. So this is what I'm going to conclude with, so I thought I would begin with it. One is that what we often think about the labor market and where it's heading may not be aligned with where it is actually heading. And again, I'll share some data with you. We've been at this school reform effort, at least this iteration, for about 25 years, and essentially we haven't moved the needle, any needle that you want to look at in terms of academic performance. And that there is more than one way of winning. A colleague of mine, Ken Gray at Penn State, wrote a book a few years ago with that title, and I've stolen it since he's retired. But I think it captures the idea that there isn't one way to help young people become successful adults. And yet, in our conversation and indeed in our policy, we have drifted to a focus on essentially one way. And then I will present data that suggests that a rigorous career and technical education curriculum is a cost-effective strategy to help young people succeed in school and beyond. So, let's delve into it. I have made copies of the pictures that I'll be sharing with you. So let's start with the labor market. One of the most interesting and pervasive kinds of myths is that everything emerging in the world today is STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And yet when you look at the labor market and actually sort out those occupations that are considered STEM-related, currently represents approximately 5% of the roughly 130 million people working, and is projected to grow to maybe 5.3% in the year 2018. Now, I'll refer to that year frequently through here on the labor market data. That's the current range of projections put out by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is the source for much of the labor market data. In fact, when you look at what's going on in terms of majors and graduates from colleges and universities with baccalaureates, doctorates, and masters, the most recent data suggests we're graduating well over 400,000 U.S. citizens or permanent residents with credentials in science and engineering, and we're producing, and I want to qualify this next number in a second, but we're producing annually about 150,000 new job openings for people with those credentials. So the math would suggest that it's more than double the number needed, and it's had an interesting effect on wages. For people in these classifications, that's a whole other set of slides, but just trust me that there are data that suggests that the wages for people in these categories have actually declined. Now, the caveat in much of these data is that, how shall I put this gently, they're pre-crash data for the most part. Pre-recession, pre-crash, pre-disaster, pre-whatever you want to call it. The labor market is evolving in ways that are fundamentally restructuring the labor market. We saw this last time in the early 90s, but I think what we're seeing now is different by a good deal, and no one can really predict where that's heading. On the other hand, we do know some things, and it's useful to pay attention to that which we're sure about. A report recently from the National Research Council, for those of you who aren't familiar with the work they do, the National Research Council was actually created during the Lincoln administration. It has a long history of addressing, by the way, some of the same people are serving on it. I've met them. It was formed by the federal government to pull together the best minds around different topics and different issues. A report in 2008 included this comment. And it was a comment that said, essentially, we don't need more scientists. What we need are scientists who can work. And they went on to talk at some length in this report about what we have come to call soft skills. And I'm going to come back to that later on in terms of what the need is for working in the workplace. So it isn't that we need more of them. We need more of them who can actually work with the person sitting next to them. So again, another way to slice and dice the data and is to think about how labor market economists crudely, I would argue, sort of segment the labor market into sort of low skill, meaning that it requires a year or less of preparation and training to be a successful person in that occupation, to middle skill occupations, which require some post-high school credential, but sub-baccalaureate, and then high skill. And if you take all of the assembled projections of the roughly 50-some thousand job titles that the Bureau of Labor Statistics tracks, and break them into these three categories, what you see is the anticipated growth, the largest of which is in what we call middle skill occupations. The smallest growth area is in what we would consider high skill occupations. Now, you've probably heard the phrase high skill, high wage. I would add one other high to that series of highs, and that is highly exportable. One of the intriguing phenomenons that's been occurring over the last 10 to 15 years is, and I assume you're well aware of the phenomenon of us shipping low-skilled work offshore. Well, we're now shipping increasingly high-skilled work offshore, because high-skilled work is ordinarily associated with the use of technology, and if it's associated with the use of technology, it can be done anywhere in the world. If you're Siemens Corporation, if you're IBM, if you're any one of those kinds of manufacturers, you can hire a pretty competent engineer from India coming out of their system of education for approximately $7,000 a year. In the United States, that same position starts at somewhere between $60,000 and $70,000 a year. There are no such things as national corporations anymore. Just look under the hood of your Ford Taurus. We are international globalized marketplaces, international globalized companies. And so the notion of high skill, high wage also needs to be thought of in terms of highly exportable. Medical technology, medical research, there is even a university that is offloading, offshoring its grading of freshman compositions. That's scary. So if we look at what the business community is saying about middle skill occupations, they make a couple of interesting points. The third one is the one that speaks specifically to the comment I just made, and that is that middle skill occupations, almost by definition, are not exportable. They require face-to-face contact either with the point of production or with the service being provided. Think of registered nurse. Registered nurses in most states require a two-year RN. This fits into the middle skill category, very well paid, and if they're going to jab you with a needle, they have to be in physical proximity to you, and so on and so on. So can say a lot more about that, but let me just suggest that what a lot of people don't understand, and I would argue most school-based people have no real idea about, is the incredible options out there in this middle skill category. Now keep in mind, most of these require some education, preparation, or training beyond high school, but they don't require a four-year college degree. And there's a wonderful publication that I tout regularly, and that's at the bottom there. It's 300 best jobs that don't require a four-year college degree. And I try to get every high school counselor to at least have it on his or her shelf, if not actually look at it. Another way to think about middle skill is to think about the kinds of credentials associated with that in relation to traditional other kinds of degrees. So we know that in the sub-baccalaureate market, if you get an industry credential, which is not necessarily an associate's degree, that 43% of those licenses and certificates earn more than people who acquire a two-year associate's degree. We know that 27% of those people earn more than the average person who graduates with a baccalaureate. And on average, 31% of people with associate degrees earn more than those with a baccalaureate degree. And if you question that, I urge you to go to the Mall of America and ask the person behind the cash register what their major was in college. It's a game I used to play. By the way, when we lived here in Minnesota and they built that place, my wife was in Seventh Heaven. She refers to it as the mothership. We're now in retail therapy, and she's recovering nicely. Another way to cut and slice the data is to think about sort of the aggregate educational credentials demanded in the labor market that's emerging. There are two sets of colored columns there, and the reason is there are two competing scenarios, one by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the other by labor market economist in Georgetown University in a place called the Center for Education and Work. Now, what's really fun to do, if you're of a mind, is to sit and listen to two sets of labor market economists argue about data and argue about projections. You may recall that Harry Truman once pined for a one-armed economist so that they would quit saying, on the other hand, true story. What these data show, the red bars are the Center on Education and Work. They simply say there are three categories of education credentials. Baccalaureate and above, which is the red bar to the furthest left. I think, unfortunately, on your diagram, it's probably in a grayscale. That represents the percentage of occupations that require a baccalaureate or more. This is the most optimistic prediction, and it suggests that about 30 to 31% of the occupations that are available over the next decade will require a baccalaureate degree. Another 28% or so will require what they refer to as some college. which includes certificates, diplomas, associate degrees, sub-baccalaureate. The red bar on the far right are occupations that are assumed based on the best available information to require a high school or less. It's the largest of the three bars. The blue bars, or the other set, and again, I apologize, could print this out in color for you. This is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They predict that there will only be about 20% of the occupations emerging that will require a college credential. They break out the other categories somewhat differently in terms of associate degrees, post-secondary awards, work experience, and short to long-term job training, or OJT. The point in all of this is that regardless of their take on the future, the need for people with baccalaureate degrees is at best about 30% of the emerging jobs, and more likely closer to the 20% range. And yet, as we think about our conception of school, we've increasingly moved to this phenomenon that has been referred to as college for all. And so, that's the workplace. Now, for the last 25 or so years, we have been steadily moving toward not moving toward, but actually adding more required core academics to the curriculum required for graduation. In the early 1980s, the average high school student who graduated, and I emphasize who graduated, earned roughly 13 core academic credits. Currently, it's pushing 20, and that's the span of about 20 years. And so, again, if we think this is a good idea, there are data that contest that assumption. And so let me share some of those data with you now. The idea of rigor, this has, I'm sure, been part of a conversation. The usual way that rigor has been defined is simply adding more. If we're not happy with the math skills of kids, make them take more math. If we're not happy with the scientific knowledge of our young people graduating, make them take more science. On the face value, it seems like a reasonable assumption, but if you actually say these two words together and add a third syllable, you get what the effect has been on a lot of young people in school today. So let's look at what we've actually accomplished by doing this. If we look at overall reading skills of young people, by the way, I'm drawing data here from the National Assessment for Educational Progress, or National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP. The U.S. Department of Ed has been collecting these kinds of data for, actually going back into the 1970s on some of their tests. So it gives us an opportunity to really look at what happens when we keep adding more academic courses to requirements for kids to get out of school. And in that span of time on general reading skills, where we've gone from 13 to nearly 20 core academic credits, reading skills have declined significantly. That is to say that there is a real drop in the reading skills of young people. In fact, today only about a third of young people graduate from high school proficient in reading, despite the fact that we've added more and more core academics to the curriculum. And proficiency in reading is considered a first step to being successful in college. If we look at science, there has been a similar significant decline in the scores of kids on tests that they give related to science. The second bar at the bottom with the that's shorter, that goes from 150 to 147, is the U.S. Department of Ed has changed all of the tests. And it's you can't actually continue the trend line. The tests are different tests, different metrics, and so we can't continue that. But in science, that was the first one they changed, and in the short period of time between the late 90s and the early aughts, there was a significant decline. And yet we've more than doubled the number of credits in science young people are taking before they graduate. We look at mathematics, we find something interesting. There was a significant increase in the math skills of kids between the mid-80s and the mid-90s, but that was before we started requiring young people to take more math. Since we've been adding the math credits on, and again, more than doubled them, the scores on math, on the NAEP, have remained essentially stable. They bobbled up and down a few points one way or the other every few years. But there's been no significant effect. The ACT, which has a way of monitoring this, asked the question and produced an interesting paper that asked the question of, what about these kids who do well in high school math? How well do they do in college math, their first college math course? And their metric was, on the one end, they looked for kids who got a B or an A in Algebra 2, which is considered the new gateway course. Used to be Algebra 1, used to be 1 year of math, used to be breathing, so we keep sort of, moving the bar a little bit. They found that 43% of those kids who took the ACT test, now keep this in mind, that with the exception of a couple of states, ACT is an optional test. Kids who take it are expecting to go to a college that requires high scores on the ACT. So these are, if you will, the best and brightest. Of those kids who took the test and got a B or an A in Algebra 2, 43% of them could not really muster a good passing grade in their first high school or college math course. All of this suggests that what we're doing and how we're doing it simply is not working. And we have about 25 years of evidence now. And yet, state after state after state is continually, in, with the best of intentions, I would argue, thinks that the way to solve the problems that we perceive is to simply have kids take more and more of the same, taught often in the same way. Now, I have to also offer two caveats here. One is, I'm the father of five children now, I think. Well, they always write home for money, so I'm pretty sure it's five. The youngest is 23 and completing studies, and I really hesitate to say this, but UW-River Falls in agricultural education. Where did we go wrong? My oldest is 43, and amongst them they have children. I have lived this issue. Of those five kids, one was a high school dropout who is in her late 30s now and owns and operates her own web-based business. My oldest daughter has two art degrees from Virginia Commonwealth University, which is a highly regarded art school, and for most of her life managed a roofing company. One of my sons got through high school only because of two motivating factors. That's where the auto shop was, and that's where the girls were. End of conversation. Two overeducated parents, that's the only way we could get him kicking and screaming to cross that stage in June of his senior year. And then my other son thinks he's going to be Steven Spielberg because he keeps going to college waiting to drop out, and he loves movies. So these are not just numbers to me. I have, and as many of you probably have, experienced what this really means when young people go through these kinds of experiences in high school and what happens after high school. Now, one thing that we're pretty sure about is that the rate at which young people complete high school has been on a steady decline since the late 1970s, early 1980s. The current estimate, and these are estimates because this is a difficult figure to really nail down, but the current estimate is that about 68, maybe 70% of young people who start ninth grade actually finish high school on time. And as you can see from this graphic, the line has been on this downward drift for the last 25 or 30 years. This is the first generation of kids, according to a RAND study that was discussed in the Houston Chronicle, this is the first generation of kids that is less likely to finish high school than the preceding generation. I would argue this is the necessary and first consideration in terms of education policy that we really have to address. The idea that all kids are going to college, the data suggests it isn't necessary. There are a lot of reasons for going to college, but if we're thinking labor market, we might want to consider alternatives. But we really need to think very hard about what we can do to make sure young people finish high school first. And this is one where we clearly trail just about everybody else in the world in terms of adolescents who finish what they consider secondary education or the public education component of their life. So we know that's true. Bob Lehrman, who's a labor market economist who writes about these topics, argues that we're rightfully concerned about the future labor market, but he argues we're looking in the wrong direction. It isn't just about schools, that there are many other things we need to think about, and what we really need to think about are the skills that employers actually need and want, not what we assume they need and want. And this is my second rhetorical question of the day, and it's simply this. If an educated workforce is critical to the siting of manufacturing and major businesses, I would ask rhetorically, why does Toyota, BMW, General Electric, Boeing, and many, many other large, high-tech manufacturing firms locate in communities where arguably they have some of the worst public education in the United States? I have met with executives from all of these companies over the last couple of years. And I can tell you what the answer is, and it has absolutely nothing to do with the quality of the workforce. Otherwise, they'd all be here in Minnesota. A few in Iowa, but you know, we've got to give Iowa something. They have so much going against them. I lived here for 21 years. I have the Iowa-Minnesota joke book. It, flip it around, it works both ways. That was the first gift I got when I came here. So, what are the academic skills necessary? Now, there are those who argue that the skills necessary to succeed in college are the exact same academic skills necessary to succeed in the workplace. I would take exception with that, but let's assume that for the moment. ACT has done some really interesting analysis of this, and they, by the way, make this argument. They have something called a work readiness assessment that's based on ONET data, and I keep throwing acronyms, and I apologize, but ONET is a Bureau of Labor Statistics test. The U.S. Department of Labor over the last, probably 30 years or more, has been looking very closely at what people actually do in the workplace, what sort of skills are necessary, what sort of work they do. And this ONET thing is a measure of the academic skills, and there are three. The ability to read for information, the ability to locate information, and what they would call applied math. Okay? So accept that for the moment. This report took a look at what are called Zone 3 jobs. Now, Zone 3 jobs are primarily middle-skill occupations, and they are occupations that pay enough for what are defined as a living wage, if you will, and they actually have a much higher estimate of what that is than what is normally assumed. So what they're looking at are occupations that are in this middle skill range that pay pretty good money. And I want to give you an example of one to show you what this means in real terms. This is from a report they did, and I hope you can read this on your paper because it's a little, maybe you can read it up there. I'm taking just one content area, algebra. They have reading, they have geometry, they've got other areas, but just for the sake of conversation. When you look at the column on the far right, it's the applied math test, if you will. These are the skills necessary for a level 5 occupation. Again, level 5, middle skill, pays pretty good wages, kind of jobs we want young people to aspire to and hopefully obtain. Again, middle skill, they're not going to be exported, it has all those wonderful attributes. When you look at the kinds of math necessary that's considered appropriate for those jobs, even though this is listed under algebra, I would argue that things like calculating percentages, discounts, and percentage markups is a skill learned probably in fourth, fifth, or sixth grade. In fact, when you look at a lot of the research that's out there, what we find is that the math skills actually necessary in the workplace are essentially those skills that are learned in elementary and middle school. Some algebra, a little bit of geometry, and that's about it. So let's take a real job. Here's one, electronic tech. This particular job posting listed this as a starting salary between $35,000 and $45,000 a year, depending on credentials. These are the kinds of requirements that were listed. And if you actually look at the kinds of skills they represent, the first two are technical skills, knowledge of PCs and serving systems, networking principles. The third bullet is experience. The next three are soft skills, motivated, energetic, communication skills, work ethic, organizational skills. When I was talking with those executives from those manufacturing firms, without exception, the first thing they talked about in terms of their interest in future workforce were broadly described as soft skills. I had the guy from General Electric Plant down in Spartanburg, South Carolina. He said, you know, I want somebody who can come in here and look me in the eye and shake my hand. I'm going, okay, do you want him to? That's the first thing that they talked about. They talked about the ability to be there in a workplace and work with others. Because all of these workplaces are evolving into situations that were different than what I experienced when I actually used to work for a living, probably different than from what you may have experienced or are experiencing now. The workplace of today, not tomorrow, but today, is team-based. It's an evolving kind of thing. The sort of hierarchies that used to exist are mostly gone. BMW in South Carolina, major manufacturing plant. BMW's plant in South Carolina exports every single vehicle that they manufacture to guess where? Europe. Again, I would argue that South Carolina's education system isn't the most stellar in the United States, but over half of their workforce are temp workers. You have to work there as a temp for almost 10 years before you can become a permanent worker. This is a scary change that's occurring in the workplace. It gives them maximum flexibility. They've essentially got factories full of 1099 workers, although they actually do offer some benefits. And then you see more tech skills, Microsoft Office applications, troubleshooting skills, but the rest of that experience, is what they're looking for. They're looking for people that have been exposed to these kinds of equipment, to these kinds of experiences. Now, this particular occupation, most of these ads, is one of the credentials they're looking for, is something usually an applied associate's degree. I'll come to a suggestion later. But essentially, again, this is what we're talking about. Good jobs, pay well, has good benefits, and essentially we're talking skills that can be learned in high school, but also in the community colleges. Now, just another measure of math, and I focused on math. I could talk about literacy, we could talk about science, but math is the one that we've been doing most of our research on of late. Most workers use math in the workplace, but most workers use what is considered basic numeracy: addition, subtraction, multiplications, fractions, estimation, and measurement, and facility with those. A smaller percentage use higher than basic, a very small percentage use algebra 2, or trig, or something else like that. So again, the challenge in all of this is, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with having kids sit through a trig class, but the curriculum space available for young people is a zero-sum game. There are only so many hours in the day, whether we slice it into 7 class periods, 6 class periods, do block schedule, it doesn't matter. We've got about 6.5 hours, give or take. That's a zero-sum game. We have only X number of days a year because we can't let go of our agricultural heritage, because if we do, parents scream about vacations. I've been in those school districts that have done that. So the idea of actually going to school like people go to work, yeah, forget it. It's not going to happen here. So it's a zero-sum game. And as we add more and more and more, we're squeezing out the options to engage kids with things that actually, A, benefit them, and B, may actually interest them. So if we think about, again, other ways of slicing and dicing the skills employers are looking for, as I mentioned when I was talking to those manufacturing people and also people from the labor unions who were part of these conversations, these are the kinds of things they talked about. They want people who can think. They want people who can ask questions. They want people who can actually, you know, write a sentence with a verb and a noun. You know, Vanna, can I buy a verb? They want responsibility. They want ethics. They need to know something about systems and how systems work. This is the curriculum that we need to be figuring out how to deliver in our schools for our young people if we're going to have any hope that they'll be successful as adults. And the only place I find this kind of curriculum is in career and tech coursework and programs, and I would also argue a lot of this is delivered through career tech student organizations, as my colleagues in their nice blue jackets up there can probably attest. The other set of skills, of course, are technical in nature. One of the things that a report that I alluded to early, and I'll come back to again, it's called Learning for Jobs. It's a recent study done by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, another acronym. OECD is an international organization that includes, I can't remember the number of countries, but includes the United States. They, in 2010, published a study looking at how the different nation states, including the United States, prepare young people to move into the workplace. And one of the things they found, among many things they found, is that those countries that are most successful at this have kids exiting their public education system by whatever name, at whatever age, with immediate job skills that employers value and want. We don't do that, or we do very little of it. We've been doing some research looking at the industry certifications that could be available through high school level programs. Right now we have data from 4 states. And just in those 4 states, we've identified 132 different industry credentials that could be delivered through existing career and tech programs. The credential is the key. That's what you need to get the attention of employers.
Dr. Stone,
yes.
Before you leave this slide,
yes, ma'am.
We heard the Florida story last night, many of us, and they offer an industry certification.
Yes.
Could you comment just briefly on what you know about that?
What I know of it, the idea of a couple of years ago they passed legislation that essentially required all CTE programs to lead to an industry certification. That's kind of good and bad. It's good because obviously these certifications are critical, but career and technical education, in addition to preparing people for the workplace, also has other missions. Preparing people for family and community living is one. That's an important one. There's the social dynamic that's a piece of it. And there aren't necessarily industry credentials for those. Perhaps there should be. It's an interesting, it's only about 2 or 3 years old, I think. as I understand it. And it's one of those kinds of things that we're looking at in the work that we do, because it is an interesting model. Conceptually, the idea of linking programs to credentials is important, but understand that there are a lot of occupational areas that don't have credentials. In Europe, if we take Germany or Austria as an example, there are approximately 250 to 300 apprenticeable occupations. 250 to 300. That covers virtually 90% of the workforce. Arnold Schwarzenegger was a marketing apprentice in Austria, and it has served him well, one could argue, or maybe not. In this country, at last count, we've got somewhere between 8,000 and 9,000 industry credentials. We really don't know, because they keep popping up. We don't have the sort of structure. So if you take programs like business and marketing, which are excellent preparation for college business and marketing, there aren't too many credentials associated with that curriculum at all, at any level, unless you perhaps move into accounting as a kind of an offshoot, or network administration. So one of the challenges in that is, although it's a good idea conceptually, it could have the effect of narrowing the curriculum or the availability, because not every kid is necessarily interested in those things. They might be interested in these things that could lead in a direction, but it's much further down the road.
Thank you, Dr. Stone. Please proceed.
And I love Florida. Soon be underwater, but I love it nonetheless. So let's think about sort of a mythical group of 100 kids who enter high school today. Again, best estimates are maybe 70 of those 100 finish high school. This means that our system nationally is putting about 30% of entering ninth graders into the workplace with not even a high school credential to hand to an employer and say, please hire me, I can do work. And by the way, these data vary considerably between the states, or among the states, as well as within states. So there's one state in this union where approximately 55 to 57% of ninth graders statewide finish high school. At the high end, it's about 87 to 90%. Depends on whose numbers you believe. But most states hover down around the 68% mark, 70% mark that I shared with you earlier. But let's follow this cohort. So now of those remaining 70, we know from recent data that 62% will move on to higher education within the first year or two. This means we're now putting another 25% of that original cohort into the workplace with a high school credential. So we've got about half of the kids who start ninth grade who wind up in the workplace with high school or less as a credential to present to an employer. 43 start college, almost half will drop out within the first year or so. 31% of them will drop out having earned zero credits. And the short version of that is they do so because they fail everything, or they get stuck in remedial courses which carry no credit. So you get an A in English 001, it counts for nothing. If you get a C minus in English 101, you get 3 credits. So that's the kind of scenario that we have there. So now we have another 19% of that original cohort moving into the workplace with some credits and a lot of debt, typically. And so we have a system that works reasonably well for about a quarter of the kids who start high school. Now, I would argue that this is not something that we can continue to sustain. And I would argue that career and technical education is one of the interventions we could think about that could really adjust these numbers. So let's look at what we know from our friends overseas. This report that I alluded to earlier, by the way, I'm sorry, this is the second report that I highly recommend. Harvard University, of all places, led by a man named Bob Schwartz, has been engaged in a study looking also, but from an American perspective, on these vocational and education training systems that exist around the world. And by the way, this VET, or vocational education, is the term used everywhere else in the world except the United States. When I go to China, when I go to Japan, when I go to Europe, when I go places and talk about this, the first question they ask is, what's CTE? So I'll use the term VET in some of these data because that's the term the reports use. But it's talking about somewhat the same kind of thing. The first point they make, or they point out that these systems in all of these countries they've looked at, the VET opportunity is the first choice for a lot of kids, not the choice for those kids that we think can't make it in college. That's an interesting, different take on what occupationally oriented education might do. And the other thing that I find really fascinating is kids who go through these systems, and we're talking in France, we're talking in Finland, we're talking in Sweden, we're talking in all kinds of places around the world. These young people exit these systems at approximately the age of 18 with the equivalent education of what we make kids wait until they go to a two-year tech college to acquire. They do it much earlier. And they're out in the workforce as productive adults while our kids are still sort of wandering the countryside thinking about what they want to be when they grow up. And I know that to be true because I used to see a lot of them when I taught freshman classes at the university. It's an expensive kind of career exploration program. So that's one of the interesting points. And if you look at, again, from this other report that I mentioned, is countries in that report, the percentage of kids who were in these intensive work-based learning kinds of VET, if you will, career tech ed, ranged from 5% in Ireland to 80% in the Czech Republic. We have so few kids who meet that definition that we didn't even show up on the chart. So, what's one of the measures we could look at? I realize as legislators in tough economic times, you are looking for where is the maximum return for the kind of taxpayer investment that you need to think about. And let me suggest that there are data out there that suggests career and tech ed is a pretty good investment if we look simply at nothing else other than return on investment. Now, there are about three or four states that have done analyses of this. Tennessee did an analysis they recently published, and they found that for every dollar spent, it returned $1.99 on that investment. Now, they looked at a number of factors, the percentage of kids who stayed in school, they looked at, in other words, they costed out all of these kinds of things and assigned value to it. Oklahoma, I don't know what's going on in Oklahoma, but their calculation was 12-to-1 ratio. That's extraordinary. I also think their numbers are fuzzy. But nonetheless, it's pretty impressive. Recent reports have shown there are direct economic returns to individuals. A recent study of career academies, which is another way to think about high-quality career and tech ed, after 8 years, they found that the annual earnings gain for kids who went through that kind of high school experience compared to kids who went through a traditional high school experience was about 11%. Now, those are real dollars. Those are real dollars. So if we think about where we need to focus our attention, let me suggest three things to consider. One is this notion of student engagement. Another is achievement. And the third is this notion of transition. Let me zip through some of these quickly. And I apologize because I'm going to be kind of dumpy with some more data here. One of the first questions we began to look at more than 10 years ago was whether or not, what do we do about this dropout problem? Does career and tech have a role to play in keeping kids engaged, which one measure of which is finishing something, like high school? And what this graphic represents are three groups of kids, high, average, and low ability. The top line are low ability kids measured by test scores, and I want to emphasize that. Green line are average, and the blue line are high ability. As you move from left to right on the graphic, what it shows is an increasing ratio, increasing percentage of the high school experience that consists of career and tech ed. And what you notice is for all three lines, they drop. That is to say that for low ability kids, the probability of dropping out of high school when they have zero career tech ed is about 45%. When they have a ratio of roughly one career tech course to two academic courses, math, science, social studies, and so forth, when you have that 1-to-2 ratio, the probability of dropping out of high school drops to 12%. There's an effect for average and high ability kids, because believe it or not, high ability kids also drop out of high school. But as you can see, the curves flatten out more quickly. The point is simply this: career and tech coursework of any kind, not anything specific, has this effect of causing young people to figure that's worth showing up next Monday. We did another study. We found something similar. We cited this study in three high poverty communities. We were testing school structure as well as course taking patterns. And above the dotted line is good, below the dotted line is bad. But what's critical about this picture for this conversation is in all three high poverty communities, two urban, one West Coast, one East Coast, one rural community, high poverty, high second language learners, participation in career and tech coursework of any kind is associated with finishing high school. Different kind of study, same results. We've done two others since that have parallel findings. So there's a powerful argument to be made that investing in career and tech ed keeps kids in school, and that's part of that return on investment. So let me just quickly walk through some things here. When we look at career and tech ed, and you think about the kinds of policy decisions that you may want to have school systems think about, there are at least three components that we know are characteristic of high-quality career tech programs: classroom instruction, authentic work-based learning, and career and tech student organizations. Let me just share with you a couple of studies we did. We've been looking very closely at this notion of curriculum integration, the idea of through an agriculture class, teaching science, mathematics, teaching whatever the academic content may be, can you do that in a way that helps kids master the underlying mathematics, the underlying science and reading and so forth? And what we found was this. We found that using three standard measures of academic achievement, we were able to significantly improve the math skills of kids in auto technology, IT, business, agriculture, and health occupations. And let me just skip down here. What we found was that in doing so, we were able to do this without taking away the technical occupational skills that they were also developing. Because again, those are critical. We were able to add the math without losing the other part that is critical. And we have some principles that have emerged that we use for our technical assistance to states program. What was very interesting about this study is we went back a year later, and what we found was the teachers, one of the problems with education reform efforts, you have these really cool interventions, and you go in, you work with teachers, and something good happens very often. But when the interventionists leave, what teachers tend to do is drift back to whatever they were doing before. And that's not unusual. It's human behavior. So we went back a year later to find out if the teachers were still using the stuff. And what we found was 3/4 of the teachers who were in the experimental group, and by the way, this was an experimental design. We had 3,000 kids, 200 teachers in 9 states. Huge study. What we found were the teachers who were part of that experimental group, 3/4 of them were still using the stuff, even though we weren't around to kind of motivate them. We found that 20% of the control teachers were using the stuff. Now, the control teachers got everything when we were done, but they didn't get the experience, the professional development. But what was really fascinating, the point I want to make here is that, and this was not part of the study, 60% of the math teachers who were partners in this, now, they didn't teach the math. The CTE teachers taught the math, but the math teachers were partners in helping them design the lesson plans. 60% of those math teachers were using the lesson plans developed for occupational, vocational classes in their math classes because they saw that as a better way to teach underlying mathematical concepts. We did one in literacy, preliminary results. We tested 2 different models. We're finding an effect there. I won't go into all the detail here. Just let me quickly talk about student organizations. We did a small study. We haven't had a chance to do the follow-up study that tried to look at the net effect of career tech student organizations on 4 factors, or based on 4 kinds of experiences. All career tech student organizations do professional development, leadership development. They engage the kids in social activities of one sort or another, and they have some kind of competitive event, which I would argue is a form of authentic assessment. And what we found was that on all 4 of those things, the most powerful predictor of any kind of academic gain, whether it's academic engagement, actual grades, college aspirations, and the like, the most powerful predictor were those competitive events. A chance for young people to engage with other people who've had similar experiences and really test their skills in front of professionals from those fields. That's a powerful component that we think should be enlarged and provided to more students. The final component is work-based learning. And let me just suggest that the value of work-based learning, if we think about that high school completion question, one of the values, because there are academic values as well. If you look at this graphic, you find the countries where a sizable percentage of young people engage in intensive work-based learning have higher high school completion rates. The United States is down towards the lower left because, again, we have fewer students who engage in those kinds of activities. So I would leave you with one more philosophical point of view, and it's from Paul Barton, who's a labor market economist at Educational Testing Services. We have moved to a point in our culture where high school has become the new middle school. That is to say that high school is less and less having any intrinsic value in and of itself except as the next step for something next. And when we know that a substantial percentage, whether the figure is 40% or 50% of kids who start ninth grade will never set foot on a college campus, the assumption that preparing them to become successful adults is something that happens after high school is to seriously condemn almost half of the kids in high school today to failure. Paul Barton makes this point, and that high school is the last publicly funded opportunity we have to help young people succeed as adults. After that, now there's absolutely nothing wrong with staying in college the rest of your life. I'm testimony to that. But I would argue that you have two constraining issues. One is cost, and the other is capacity. Once you leave high school, if the assumption is that workforce development is going to start there, or if the assumption is that everything you need to know to be successful in adults is going to start there, tuition costs have been going up dramatically. The ability of people to pay for that has decreased dramatically, and you have a capacity issue. Community colleges around the country are closing their doors because of budget cuts. They have fewer staff and they have higher demand because people recognize the value of those credentials. So one of the things to really think about, and this is much beyond what we can think about today simply, is why do we make our kids wait? Why not look at those intensive technical education opportunities that are provided through technical colleges and community colleges like they do everywhere else in the world except here? And why not make them available to adolescents? It's something to think about. So where I started is where I'll end. I hope that in the brief few minutes I've had, I've been relatively persuasive that if the labor market is part of our thinking, we should pay very close attention to what's actually going on in the labor market. And that while STEM is really sexy, it's kind of the new high tech. Some of you may remember back in the 70s and 80s, everything had to be high tech. Well, now everything has to be STEMified. And while there are certainly wonderful opportunities in that occupational arena, it's a relatively small percentage of the overall labor market. The idea that simply continuing to stack on more traditional academics taught in traditional ways is somehow going to move the needle just hasn't proven to be the case. We really need to think about other ways of helping young people win. And then finally, I would argue that a rigorous career and technical education program that combines integrated curriculum, work-based learning, and student organizations is one very cost-effective strategy for addressing these problems. So if you are so intrigued with this that you want more information, you can reach me either through our website, we have lots of this research there, or directly through my email. And I'll be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Dr. Stone. This was very, very enlightening. Can you point us to a state that might be doing this or beginning to do this that we could look to as a model? Because that's what we need. We need to see something that's working or at least started to work so that we can discuss.
Two places to look.
Dr. Stone.
First of all, I would say that across the country there are schools and school districts doing a lot of this. But on a statewide basis, Massachusetts and California. California has a program or project that's called ConnectEd, funded through the Irvine Foundation, which does a lot of this. Massachusetts has a program of, and they still call them often vocational schools, that one in particular that we've done some research on, it's a regional vocational center, Blackstone Valley Tech. They have an honest graduation rate of about 99%. Virtually every kid who starts there in ninth grade finishes. They are the second highest scoring school on the state MCAS, which is considered the most rigorous high school exit exam. Mm-hmm. And even though it's a vocational school, their lens is on preparing young people with skills employers value, and virtually every kid graduates with at least one and some two and three industry credentials. Mm-hmm. Because of that focus, more than 70% of their graduates go on to post-secondary education, usually in a technical area. Extraordinarily successful school. Minuteman Tech is up in outside of Boston. Has a similar kind of track record. When Jefferson County, where I now live in Louisville, as I had to learn how to say, was looking at reforming and refining their whole school system, they went to Massachusetts to look at what they were doing. And they have come back and they've done some really interesting things. But the other point that I would make is that this isn't going to happen next Monday morning.
No.
The first thing that the people at Blackstone will tell you is this is 10 years in the making. They didn't try to just do everything all at once. They have stepped in reforms on a kind of, first thing they worked on was literacy, no surprise. It's foundational to everything. And then they worked on something else. They worked on something else. They worked on something else. They have fully implemented about 8 or 9 or 10 kind of reforms, if you will. Got to quit doing those air quotes. It's annoying, I know. My grandson who lives with me now goes around the house. He's 6 years old going, Granddad. It's amazing what genetics and behavioral, anyway. But they will tell you it's taken them 10 years to get to this point. So it's important to keep that in mind because I've learned, kind of observing, in the policy political world, we want things to happen by usually the next election. Mm-hmm. We've got to have a longer window to think about how we make things work better because it's taken us a long time to get to where we are now.
So, Dr. Stone, do they have a lot of partnerships with the business and industry? Would you comment on that?
One of the characteristics is every one of their occupational programs has an advisory committee. Now, advisory committees, there are various kinds. Some are those who show up once a year to get their brass on wood plaque for showing up once a year. And at the other end are advisory committees where mentorships are offered, apprenticeships are offered, where they have their experts in the classroom working with kids. They also, a lot of these advisory committee provide people who do really good career guidance, career counseling, under the guidance of the school's career guidance counselors. One of the keys to this that is very hard to address is the fact that we do precious little good career guidance in public education, and we don't have the resources. So that's not going to change. So the other way to think about this is like they have, is how do you leverage community resources to provide that value to kids? It's absolutely necessary if any of this is going to work. We can't assume that kids are going to show up at age 15 or 16 and we ask them to make a decision absent any kind of developmental work between them and their parents and thinking about what life could be like. So that yes, very intensive and very extensive relationships with the community at large.
In regard to the apprenticeship programs, does there have to be a liability insurance because the students are moving to the site? Is there any concern that we should have about that mobility?
Probably yes, and it differs from state to state. I know that when I was teaching high school back a long time ago, and put students into work situations using the Target Job Tax Credit, which was a federal program that was very effective in getting young people into workplace. It was an issue in the state of Virginia where I taught. But the law itself had kind of a rider. And some states have those riders that say if the student is in a supervised work experience program, by whatever language they call it, then they have kind of a waiver. But not every state has that. So that's something you would definitely want to look at. I know that there are, and I was out in St. Louis, they've been working with some manufacturing and chemical companies out there. They've worked out an arrangement that lets the young people in for kind of job shadowing, but not real work experience. So it's kind of a work-based learning light, if you will. The Toyota people that I've been working with, they bring young people in as apprentices between their junior and senior year for an 8 to 10 week apprenticeship, and they're on the line working. And then they continue to work with them through the high school, and then they come into the workplace as graduating seniors. So they've got a model where they bring students in because, again, they have trouble with that zero-sum game I talked about of getting kids out during the school year. So it's a variation, but they've been able to work out those liability issues. So it is something you will probably need to consider. Young workers under the age of 15 clearly are an issue. Mm-hmm. There's a concept that is used oftentimes of mature adolescents. Sorry. I behavior modding myself. Stop doing it. This concept of mature adolescence generally refers to 17-year-olds who are sort of on the cusp of becoming 18, and they often are treated more like adults. So depending on when you think about this, the age group, but yeah.
Ms.
Long
Larson,
answer, short question.
Ms. Larson, are you familiar with what's in law here in Minnesota in regard to... Thank you. She'll update us sometime on that. Thank you very much. Okay. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find my mind all over the place with this discussion here. Yeah. One of the things that is in conflict with some things that we've heard earlier, I wanted you to clarify for me, and that is we've been listening to lots of testimony, and we keep hearing 70% of the kids today have to have a degree of some sort, a certification of some sort for the jobs of the future. That mm-hmm. seems to not really align with what I was hearing you say, and I wondered, could you clarify that for me before I ask?
Dr. Stone.
Yes. I will, and let me flip back to a picture here real quickly. That number comes from a report on the Center on Education and Work, Tony Carnival. I mentioned him briefly as we went through. And if I can find my picture quickly, I can't find
it. It was early on. I apologize.
Yeah, that's okay. Here it is. Here's where that number comes from.
See, Dr. Stone, we did not get this printed in our printout.
Oh.
This printed blank slide.
Oh, did it really?
Yes, so we don't have this.
I apologize. Oh, I am sorry. That's because I was working on this on the plane last night, so I had time to do it right. I really apologize. This was, I showed earlier, there are two competing projections. What is on my picture, the red bars, and this is from the Center on Education and Work. If you take the roughly 30-some percent of BS and BA and add to it the sum college, that's where you get the 65 to 67% figure. Mm-hmm. Now, the difference is this definition of sum college. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is in the blue, doesn't use that. And so the problem is one of somewhat definition. So if you clump some college to the baccalaureate, that's where you get your 60-some percent. However, understand that that some college might be a three-month certificate or six-month certificate at Anoka-Hennepin or something other than college as we traditionally think of it. And indeed, if you read Carnival's report, he makes that distinction, but unfortunately the headlines come out, oh my gosh, 67% of the jobs emerging need college. And they even drop the sum. Of traditional baccalaureate, again, depending on which estimates you look at, it's 20 to 30%. If you lump in some college, because the BLS says their some college is probably adds up to about 12% with the associates and the post-secondary awards.
Representative Norton.
Yeah, and thank you. And I appreciate that because I think this committee knows, although I do think you're right, the general public misunderstands that certificate programs and technical college and all those things are important and are included in the need, not just a four-year baccalaureate degree. I had just a couple other thoughts here as I listen. One, I would take umbrage with your description of the STEM that you had up there because you put STEM and then you took out the T and the M part of STEM. And when I talk about STEM and my other job is dealing with STEM, we talk about technology and math as needs.
Right.
And I don't think you would argue with the fact that if you add technology and math back into that formula, it accounts for many of the jobs that you've discussed.
Actually, I'll take umbrage with your umbrage.
okay, you can do
that. Take exception to your umbrage. I have no umbrage left in me at this point. The STEM figure, actually there were two figures there, mm-hmm. and I went through them quickly. That STEM estimate is from the Carnival report, and that is for STEM. The other figure is about science and engineering, which is a different report. So they are two different constructs. You're absolutely correct, except I would suggest that Carnival, which has what I would argue is the most liberal view of, or the most expansive view of the future workforce in terms of college and related things, that's his figure. So he includes all of those STEM-like things. And so 5-6% is the range that he has in his report.
Well, then, I think, Madam Chair, we probably need a little more research in this area because we're hearing quite conflicting, not just from you, but from testifiers that have been here over the last month and a half, telling us some different things. So I think that's something we should look at.
Can I have one more qualifier to that?
Sure.
Dr. Stone.
One of the challenges in that is STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, one could argue, show up in virtually all workplaces.
Right.
And when they have a figure of 5 or 6% or in that range, they're looking at occupations that are solely focused in science, technology, engineering, mathematics. That's different than, say, someone who might use technology or some aspect of STEM in the course of another job. So, for example, marketing is often thought of as a single occupational cluster, but marketing cuts across all
That's
occupational
right.
arenas.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like that. So it is a definitional thing, to be sure.
And, Madam Chair, if I could just
yes,
finish my
note.
Thank you very much. The only other piece I think, and I like some of what you presented. I'd love to argue with you one-on-one on a lot of it, but we
Step
won't
out,
do that.
Sorry.
Yeah, we won't do that here. It's kind of the one-size-fits-all kind of mentality here a little bit in some of your final thoughts. I think we in Minnesota and in other states need to look at our own data and our own communities to make decisions rather than trying a one-size-fits-all solution. And frankly, I think we've done some damage at the state over the past 20 years in making changes because we look at national data, we use it, but we forget to look at our own districts. Some of our districts do remarkable things already.
Mm-hmm.
Others don't. We need to look at our own graduation data from each community and not assume that everyone's failing, that some communities have bigger challenges than others. And so And the one other area I think I'll just comment on is the partnership model. One of the things we try to do, and we've had some really remarkable results, which I think folks heard a little bit about with some things that Mayo and IBM have done down in our community with this great partnership between business and the schools. The challenge that we have is when those things come in, and it ties to when an intervention, a staff development model is used, and sometimes people keep it.
Right.
The ones who don't experience it don't get to keep it. That happens, and we have some really good experiments, not just in my community, but all across the state, that we never fan out to anyone else. They're only used in that little experiment. We don't take the good lessons that we've learned and use them other places and in other schools, even within our own community. Right now, we have a great model. Only 3 schools are getting to utilize, and a lot of it, quite frankly, has to do with funding, and the partnership can't afford to fund education in every school across the state or even in my little community. And so, you know, if we could think a little bit more about what can we do as a state to support those types of models, and when we learn something that works, not just let it only hit the classrooms that had the experience, and that's great for those folks who have it, but what about those who don't? Thank you. Dr. Stone.
3 quick comments. One is size, the world, and scale. Let me start with the latter. Bringing reforms to scale is what we look at, because that's the real question. You know, you've got the Jaime Escalantes of the world who do terrific stuff with kids who ordinarily don't do well in school. So how do you bring a Jaime Escalante to scale? So genetic cloning is the only answer I have. But that's an issue. And we do have lots of these experiments. There are 18,000 school districts in this country. And across those 18,000 school districts, there's a lot of really cool stuff going on. How do you find out about it? How do you bring it to scale? Absolutely, you're as they say in Britain, you're spot on. But I would suggest those 2 things then to kind of look at, because the Connect Ed program in California, again, it had good foundation funding to get it off the ground, but it's really scaling quickly, and it brings some of those. I'm a little familiar with what's been going on in Rochester from my time here, but that is a challenge. You know, it works. How do you scale it up? And that's often a resource question. But there are some things that aren't so resource intensive that can also have an effect, especially when you look at how we change, not what we teach, but how we teach. The idea of curriculum integration as an example. The other thing to look at, again, the Massachusetts thing would be a fairly resource-intensive kind of an approach. Works, but it takes time and money. Let me suggest that I hope I didn't suggest that one size fits all. I was arguing, I hope, just the opposite, that what I've seen is an increasing one size fits all. You know, one curriculum is the best curriculum for all kids, and it just simply is not the case. There are different learning styles, there are different all kinds of things. So if I misspoke on that cool word that was invented in the 70s with Richard Nixon, if somehow I miscommunicated, I apologize, but I'm suggesting there are multiple kinds of options that we should be thinking about. And then finally, let me just comment on Minnesota versus the world. I understand your point that we need to pay attention to Minnesota. Clearly, that's true. I would also argue, though, that these kids, like my kids and my grandkids, are not operating in a Minnesota or Kentucky market. At minimum, it's regional. And more likely, it's global. I mean, we're competing against kids in India. We're competing against kids in Venezuela. We're competing against, I mean, it is truly a global marketplace. And so paying attention to national trends is important. There are clearly local markets that need attention, and I'm not saying you don't. Robert Reich wrote a really interesting book in the late 80s called The Work of Nations, and he made this argument that there are these sort of regional clumps of knowledge skill sets. So you've got sort of, you know, Silicon Valley, if you will, in California. You've got the Research Triangle in North Carolina. You know, you had and sort of still have this kind of 3M, IBM-ish thing here in Minnesota. Although Honeywell, they sold to the mob in Jersey. Is that right? I was so sorry when they left Minneapolis. They're still there, but I was so sorry when they left Minneapolis. They're still there, but they're a shell of themselves. So, but I think it's both. And again, because of what I do and where I do it, you know, I look broadly at national stuff. But you're absolutely correct. But I would argue that you want to also pay attention to what's going on. I was in Las Vegas doing real work not so long ago, and I was talking to a guy. They were getting ready to open a new casino. They needed 6,000 sort of front-end people, front-of-the-house people, back-of-the-house people, cooks to, you know, service people, car dealers, all that kind of stuff, 6,000. They had 60,000 applicants. They needed 120 techie guys, network administrators, people that could handle the tools and equipment. They needed 120. They had 60 applicants. there's a huge mismatch. And those are really good jobs because people continue to squander money in places like that. They've got good futures. So one of the issues is, and this goes back to the Minnesota versus the world question, is that there are actually lots of opportunities elsewhere. And so kids need to know about that and understand that if they really like to do this, maybe they can't do it in Lake Wobegon. Maybe they have to go to some place that you know they've never heard of before unless they really paid attention in geography class. So, but it's a point, and I don't want to overstate ignoring the local needs.
Thank you, Dr. Stone. Before we go out to the next question, gentlemen in the audience from the University of Minnesota, would you stand, please, and introduce yourselves? These are our professors at the U, and each of you, would you stand? Or if you're even here visiting from the U.
Good morning. My name is Kenneth Bartlett. I'm Associate Professor of Graduate Professional and International Programs in the College of Education and Human Development, University of Minnesota.
John Sturtz, the University of Minnesota Office of Professional Development Outreach, which has a lot to do with training teachers for career technical education in the classroom and secondary and post-secondary.
Oh, he did. Okay. We also had others. Anyone else? Thank you. Next question, Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to go back to your beginning slides and talk about maybe some of the conclusions you made, Dr. Stone, regarding 30% of people not graduating, regarding the seemingly the curves going in the wrong direction regarding test scores with science, math, and so forth. So I'd like to start by painting a picture of a schoolhouse in which on the left side you got kindergartners coming in the door and on the right side you have 12th graders graduating or 30% of them leaving prior to graduation. And it seems like we, not just you, but we measure what happens in the schoolhouse and we measure what happens as kids leave. But we're assuming that everyone coming in as a kindergartner are the same over time. You know, year upon year upon year, and I guess in the 6 weeks I've been here, I've been trying to engage in a dialogue about what happens outside of the school, the environment, and what happens to a child over time when the environment may have improved over the last 30 years or it may have not improved. I guess we don't know because we haven't really talked about that too much. Today's kids have distractions, internet, iPods, cell phones, video games, single-parent families, drug addiction, attention deficit disorder, jobs, to name a few. There's probably hundreds and hundreds more. So I think the conclusion, or maybe not, but I wonder if you could talk about the role of the environment over the past few years and whether that has actually caused test scores to go up, all other things being equal, or whether that has contributed to the lowering of test scores, if you know.
Dr. Stone.
Okay. I'll make a few brief observations, but I'm always reluctant to step outside my area of expertise, which is extraordinarily narrow, and as I get older, I keep forgetting even what I think I know. So this environmental question has been with us actually for a long time, and the kids in school today are often referred to as digital natives. You've probably been exposed to that discussion, the idea that the iPods and so on that you know they're constantly engaged with is actually part of what to them is reality in their existence. I think there are larger social questions, though, beyond that, and I think you've tapped into some of them. I alluded to Honeywell's departure. In the 1980s, Jim Rainier was chief executive officer, whatever his title was at Honeywell, and I remember hearing a speech he gave one time. And the speech was about they were interested in what was their best return on investment in terms of education for getting the people they needed. And he told a story of how they started with the colleges and universities and realized after a little bit of time that the problem preceded the colleges and universities. So they went into the high schools and they realized that the problems that high schools were experiencing came from problems that preceded high school, which was the elementary school. Well, the short version of the story is they wound up with prenatal care. This is a serious, they opened a school. Some of you may remember that. At their international headquarters in Minneapolis, it was a school for young women who were either pregnant or had children and were trying to finish high school. And that school was housed right in the front door as you walked into their international headquarters. And their solution was similar to one that was published, it's probably been at least 10 years ago, maybe less, I've lost track of time, by the Federal Reserve Board here in the Upper Midwest. And the gentleman's name escapes me.
Art Rolnick.
Sorry?
Art Rolnick.
Yes. And one of the things that they looked at and learned and wrote about was that the best possible investment that we could make for workforce development, if you will, I'm paraphrasing, is early childhood education. But it's early childhood education of a very expensive kind. It's the kind that often has the parent involved in learning, because if you want the mother, which is often the case, to read to the child, the mother has to be able to read. And you look in high poverty communities, often the parents don't have the kind of literacy skills to read, you know, the kind of books the kids need to be reading. And there are two or three programs, and the cost of those programs averaged anywhere from $10,000 a year to almost $20,000 a year per kid. But the return on investment that they calculated from those early, rather heavy investments was just unbelievable. And they argued that that was our best response to the problems that, this was back in the 80s or 90s, I think, that Federal Reserve Board report came out. So you're absolutely correct. I don't know if conditions are worse or better. I was raised Southern Baptist, and we're convinced we're all going to hell anyway. and that's predicated on the Old Testament, because they were so concerned about young people in the Old Testament that, you know, mm-hmm. they didn't find God, we're going to hell in a handbasket. Mm-hmm. So the idea that this generation or the next generation is somehow encountering more issues, problems than maybe we remember ourselves.
Not true.
Maybe true, maybe not. But they're clearly often different. Mm-hmm. But somehow we sort of muddle through. But I guess my point is simply that it is all true. And the challenge is how we construct an educational system that allows kids to prosper and learn. Because the educational system itself isn't necessarily going to directly solve those problems that kids bring with them to the schoolhouse door. So you're right. We really, I mean, if we want to get really serious about this, I mean, I'm only talking about the stuff that we focus on, which is essentially high school and post-high school education. But the issues that lead us to a lot of these questions start much earlier. So you are exactly right on that.
Representative Beard, follow-up?
Yeah, just a follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Missouri Synod Lutheran, so we're forgiven.
By the way, my father remarried when I was about 12 and married a Pennsylvania Dutch lady who was Missouri Synod Lutheran. So I'm sort of bicultural.
Representative Greiley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stone, I've really appreciated your presentation. I find it a wealth of information and also very interestingly presented, which is also a benefit for us in the first hour of the legislative day. But I have long worried about the direction where we are going in Minnesota with focusing so much on the STEM courses and the fact that we've been increasing algebra requirements. Every kid must take Algebra 1 and every kid must take Algebra 2, and then it kind of displacing the rest of the curriculum. Also, we have the testing with focusing on reading and math and science and the things that are tested. I was going to ask the question that Madam Chair asked, what other states or places are doing better than us? Because I see us, you talked about 10 years of turning this around. Excuse me. I think it's going to, take a very long time to turn it around with the, because we're kind of going full speed ahead in mm-hmm. a kind of an opposite direction. So I'm glad we have this discussion, but I'm kind of at a loss, for how to turn it around in any short time. So I know you said it could take 10 years, it could take a lot of money, but what would be one or two things we could do to start cutting into this other direction that we're going?
Dr. Stone.
I only give one piece of advice consistently, because it's the only thing I know actually works, and that's buy low and sell high. I exactly understand your question, and unfortunately, I don't have a simple answer. I have lots of ideas, and there is no quick solution. Now, one of the challenges we face, by the way, another reading assignment for the class, Diane Ravitch recently published a book. I believe the title is The Death and Birth of the Great American School System, or something like that. Those of you who don't know the name, Diane Ravitch was an early intellectual supporter of No Child Left Behind. Mm-hmm. She comes from the liberal side of the political spectrum, and so was considered sort of a heretic by her colleagues. But she was an early advocate of standards, of testing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This book that was published about 6 months ago just simply rips No Child Left Behind apart and talks about all the damage it has done. And among the things it has done is it has narrowed the curriculum in a way that is just beyond description. There are elementary schools in this country where for 6.5 hours a day, kids get math and reading, nothing else, no recess, lousy lunches. I mean, it's just appalling. And then we wonder why they come to high school and they're bored and they're not very happy. It's an interesting read. So, three reading assignments, Learning for Jobs, Pathways to Prosperity, and The Birth and Death of the Great American High School, or the American Schools. Can't remember the exact title. I can get it for you. Short-term things that you could do. I know that, I'm aware that there are efforts to sort of add more academic requirements. I would go back to my suggestion that one of the strategies, if the content is what's important, how we package that content, I would argue, is least important. So if we think kids need more mathematics, more science, more literacy, they don't necessarily have to be delivered only in a math or a science mm-hmm. or English arts kind of course. I talked very briefly about curriculum integration. We've done very gold standard research on this, and we've shown that when you teach academic content in the context of agriculture, auto mechanics, mm-hmm. cosmetology, family and consumer science, we've tested in all areas, you can actually have kids gain better mastery. And I want to emphasize the distinction between mastery of the subject matter and getting a C- on the test so you can take the next test. There's a distinct difference. Now, I would suggest that aspects of algebra and geometry are out there alive in the workplace, especially in some of these advanced manufacturing kinds of opportunities, which are growing, by the way. I mean, manufacturing is alive and well in this country. Let's not write it off completely. But it's a different manufacturing place. Toyota has 3 job titles on their manufacturing floor. General Motors has 57. So multi-skilled workers is the concept. So you could consider, if we think this set of content is critical, first of all, hope there's some evidence for it, but let's assume the evidence is there. Then is it only necessary to be taught in a chemistry class, or could we teach that in an ag science class? If we think that some mathematic concepts are critical, can we teach those elsewhere? Years and years ago, there was something called writing across the curriculum, which is still alive and well in a lot of school districts across the country. The idea is that you can teach kids to write, to deconstruct text, do all those kinds of English skills, but you can do them in a variety of content areas. So that's a relatively is the word, low-cost thing. It requires professional development, requires some rethinking, but I would argue that rather than keep stacking on math, science, and other kinds of credits, that we focus more on having kids master the content that's actually necessary, both for college, by the way. Most liberal arts majors, by the way, require a single math course in college, and it's college math, not college algebra. If you go into engineering and science and some of those, yeah, you need a lot of math, but again, most kids don't go that direction. So let's look really seriously at what math is really necessary, both for college and careers, and I think what you'll find is that it's not everything we're having kids take, but rather it's having kids master the stuff they need to take. And again, I would argue it's kind of some algebra, some geometry, a lot of that numeracy stuff that no matter how much math kids are taking, when you test them exiting high school, they can't estimate, they can't measure. They just stumble over fractions, percentages, decimals, and all that sort of thing. But that's the day-to-day use in the workplace of mathematics. So the short-term, relatively easy fix, I can say that, is to think about how we deliver what we deliver and be clear about the importance of whatever it is we think we need to add to the curriculum. Because as we continue to add stuff, again, it's a zero-sum game. There are fixed constraints on the school day, the school year, and we push stuff out the door. The arts, career and technical education, the opportunity to really understand what the world is like around them are things that kids desperately need, and we are increasingly limiting their exposure to.
And then Manager.
Representative Greiling, I'd like you to do the follow-up, but we do need to hear from Mike Muron, who came here to talk about integration. So if you would bear with me. Mr. Muron, would you come to the table, please? Sorry, we've gotten a little carried away here.
I apologize. I'm used to speaking in three-hour increments because I'm...
Well, and we've been intrigued with your presentation, Dr. Stone, so thank you very much. But we also want to hear from the practical side. And Mr. Schoenfeld, I was going to call on him. I just was caught up in this.
Actually, I just wanted to indicate this portion of it was following up, actually, on a question about the integration. About 4 years ago, we came to this committee and asked that agricultural education be allowed through its agri-science sections and such to be able to meet the standards and benchmarks.
Yes.
And this is a demonstration. We, as ag educators, and I work with the Minnesota Association of Ag Educators, we went out and secured about $300,000 initially in grants and so forth in order to do this. And it's a MyCart system that shows you how we physically integrated the into our curriculums the standards and benchmarks that are required for science.
You know, Mr. Muron, before you begin, are we going to do justice to your presentation if we begin it now? Because we have to be out of here by 10 o'clock. And, I hate to ask you to come back on Thursday, but would that be possible?
It is possible, Madam Chair, if you...
I mean, I wish I could pay for your sub. I know that's an issue. Forest Lake High School, I guess I'll have to pay a call to them. But
I mean, it certainly can if I can get that approved by my administration, Madam Chair.
What is your pleasure, members, to have it now or to wait? I think so, too. So could you make arrangements to give this presentation first thing Thursday? Because our schedule has changed for Thursday. And if I need to talk to your school principal, please put him in touch
with
me.
I
know your superintendent well.
I will let him know that I have a pass from the state legislature to come back and visit with you Thursday morning.
Thank you very much. So we'll forestall that till Thursday and return to questions for Dr. Stone. Representative Greiling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a great idea. Excuse me, because I think that, you know, how to do this is perhaps, it sounds like what we're going to get in the next
presentation.
My other comment, that was just a comment, not a follow-up, and I just wanted to say the comment about counselors, you know, not having enough, it makes it harder for students to figure out, what classes they're going to take and how they would have equivalence. And we're kind of going down the wrong direction in that department as well.
Well, Representative Greiling, you know, there's nothing that says we're not going to have counselors, so. Representative Depke, with that said, you have the next question.
That's ironic. Okay. Thank you very much for your presentation, Dr. Stone. It was very, very interesting. I do have a question on one of your slides, and it's on personal returns. It talks about the earnings gain for Academy students per year, 11% annual gain, and 17% for males. I think it would be very helpful for the young female students that are in the room to hear from you if there is a discrepancy in technical education towards women, or and why is there the difference between the 11% and the 17%?
I have a plane to catch. That particular study. Let me see if I can call it back up here. So
it's page 6.
Yeah, let me... which one was I doing here? I'm sorry, I've been in 4 different conferences or meetings in the last 4 days, and I'm semi-disoriented. That particular study was done by the Manpower Development Research Corporation, which is one of these research outfits. It works a lot on social science, social oriented. They've done a lot of work on poverty and all kinds of things, but they also look a lot at education. They did the study, and what they and I'm reporting what they found. So let me qualify that. The way that they did the study, what they found was this: they found that for males, there were certain occupational groups. It wasn't for all males who went into all kinds of occupations. You have to kind of drill down to their tables, and on average is what I reported. It gets more fine-grained as you drill down. What they found for females in the study was they found a couple of occupational arenas, and you might expect what they are. For young women who actually went into the highly technical areas, they saw similar findings for males or for females. But the thing is that women didn't go into those areas in very large numbers. Now, also keep in mind that this was a group of kids who started high school in the mid-1990s or early 1990s. And so they've been following them. These young people are in their 30s at this point. So it's simply an artifact of what students chose to do. And so I'll say this, and female-dominated occupations do not pay what male-dominated occupations pay. Okay, and that's reasonably well known. But for young women who move into these more male-dominated occupations, for that age cohort, they tended to enjoy the same sort of earnings advantage. And again, at that time, the ones that seemed to pop up were those that were technology-oriented. But some of that wage differential has disintegrated over the last number of years for a couple of reasons. One is, I don't want to get too technical, but more people are moving in there, so it's supply and demand again. In the early to mid-90s, companies were desperate for anybody that could network some computers together. And all these little geeky boys who came out of high school had been playing with computers were snapped up. That was the beginning of the decline of males going to college in relation to girls going to college, by the way. Sure. That's when we began to see the beginning. Mm-hmm. One theory is boys were being pulled out, and primarily boys, because these were the geeky little guys with their computers, were being pulled out of the education stream with really good-paying jobs at the time. But since that time, the technology has become much more simple. I can even operate computers. And more people have those skills. So the wage differentials dropped a lot. If we were to repeat this study today, I think we might find something different. But I think part of what the other thing, by the way, which I didn't report on, is in their long-term follow-up, they have found that kids who went through these career academies, true for both boys and girls, that they have better measures of family formation and continuation. That is to say, they are more likely to be married and have kids and in stable relationships. I have no way of explaining that based on the career academy structure. It's a really anomalous finding. So the wage differential is real, but I think it's partially an artifact of the focus and the era. Does that help, or did I just confuse everything?
Representative Depke. Yes, I understand where you're coming from. I have one piece of advice for all the young students, female students. What I hear Dr. Stone say is that in order to make more money, start going into the jobs that all the men are applying for. There used to be those kinds of glass ceilings in corporate America, and they're not there anymore. So keep at it, young girls.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Dr. Stone. I'm not smashing you, but I just wanted to hear what your answer was.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Jones, you are a breath of fresh air. Not only in your personality, not only in your personality, but in your presentation, and just bringing, in my opinion, a glimmer of hope. Because from sitting here over the last weeks, we've heard that we have to be rigorous. We have to really ensure we have a high content level of teaching in math and science. And if that does not happen, then our kids would not have any hope of being successful in the future. So it's really good to hear a different perspective on what else can be done to ensure we have a strong workforce, and that comes in many different ways. So it's really, really good to hear that. And I'm really hopeful now that, you know, we don't have to really work. And we do. It's really about creating opportunities for our kids to be successful in life, and that comes in many different ways. And so a big part of what we're battling here in Minnesota is closing the achievement gap. Mm-hmm. And I would just like your insight into, do you think that your presentation in looking at the work that needs to be done in a different way can help close that achievement gap?
Dr. Stone.
Yes, thank you for the question, and thank you for the compliment. I've called many things rarely fresh air. There's some work that's been done, not by us, but by one of our partner institutions. Southern Region Education Board has a program that operates in about 30 states called High Schools That Work. And they have an analysis they've done of what they call their 2020 schools. Now, High Schools That Work takes the notion of combining rigorous career and technical education with rigorous academics, okay? And this report they've recently done on 2020 schools, they specifically targeted schools that had high levels of minority participation, high levels of poverty, high levels, in other words, schools that where typically education is an issue, a big issue. Say, not like, say, in Anoka, but, you know, like Minneapolis, for example, where I know there are some issues. What they did in their analysis was to look at schools that rigorously offered career and technical education as they think about it. And they have their own kind of model that I generally agree with, but it's a good model. And 20 schools that were part of their network that were less rigorous in their implementation. And what they found was, is in those schools, in these kinds of communities that struggle with educating all kids and closing the achievement gap, they found that, in fact, when schools followed their model and really did this, much of which I shared here, there were good things happened. I'll just broadly say it that way. That is to say that kids got better test scores, kids actually could read better. You had a whole measure of outcomes that we are interested in that actually worked better in their 2020 analysis. So I think, again, career and technical education in and of itself isn't going to solve all the issues. And the achievement gap issue that we see profoundly in high school starts back in first, second, third grade, and this was our earlier conversation. But one of the programs we looked at in a Rust Belt city, they use something called the Collins Reading Program. I don't know a lot about it, but what I do know is that in every class, every teacher teaches writing. And so for the first week or two, they have kids simply write a sentence. No instruction, just write a sentence. And then the next week, they take those same sentences and they add a verb. And then they add a noun. And they move from sentences to paragraphs, from paragraphs to papers. They do this in every single class. And in that school, which was, and it was a vocational high school, of the old style, mm-hmm. It was literally the dumping ground for that urban school district. They had six high schools. This was a place where they got every special ed kid. They got every kid that the other schools didn't want. Mm-hmm. That school, in the span of about 3 or 4 years, actually had better high school completion rates than 2 or 3 of the other sort of more esteemed comprehensive high schools. And one of the strategies they used was this intense focus on literacy. Now, it's not going to cure the problem because, the problems start earlier. And by the time a kid gets to high school, if they are 2 or more grade levels behind on basic core academic measures, I can assure you the data suggests they'll have an extraordinarily difficult time in high school. So the part of the trick is to catch it before then, but there are some things you can do through career and technical education that can certainly address the issue. But I won't sit here and promise it's going to solve the problem.
Thank Dr. you. Stone, thank you very much for this presentation. Members, if you want to ask questions, please do so. But we're going to have to close this off. Thank you again so much. This meeting is adjourned.